Thank you very much. As you'll know by now, Greenbelt this year has as its theme Dreams of Home, which I guess by this stage of the weekend is probably more to do with comfy beds, warm rooms and hot showers than anything theological. Reflecting on this, I think it's no surprise that most of the people whom God talked to about the Promised Land lived in tents. Dreams of Home is about a longing for something that is out of reach, acting as foreigners and strangers on earth, longing for a better country, a heavenly one, as Hebrews puts it. Augustine saw our earthly longing as an echo of eternity, particularly in that famous prayer, "Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." Augustine's prayer is widely quoted and used, but I don't think it tells us the whole story. But I'll come to that later. I want to start instead with a nursery rhyme. "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are." I attempt to sing this to my 2-year-old daughter to get her to sleep. There's two problems with this. One is I can't sing, and the other is she never wants to go to sleep and so usually screams. Just in case you're concerned, I have checked and the screaming isn't just because I can't sing. Anyway, it's a well-known nursery rhyme, and right at its centre is this idea of wondering, of staring up at the night sky and being moved to wonder what it is you're looking at. Richard Feynman, one of the greatest quantum physicists of the 20th century, wrote something similar as a child. He wrote, "I wonder why, I wonder why, I wonder why, I wonder. I wonder why, I wonder why, I wonder why, I wonder." That sense of wonder stayed with Feynman all his life. And it's that sense of wonder, that sense of being moved to wonder why, that I want to look at today. I'm now an Anglican minister, but before ordination, I was an archaeologist, an archaeological scientist. And in between, I was a children's worker. So a few different things, but I think that one of the continuing strands between them all is wonder, both my own or that of others. I think that it's that sense of wonder that motivates many people, many scientists, many people in their Christian journey, many artists, many other people. Plato recorded Socrates as saying, "Wonder is the feeling of a philosopher, and philosophy begins in wonder." There is, I think, a general sense of wonder that is prevalent within humanity, and which is frequently a motivating factor in many of our achievements and discoveries. This is recognised in all sorts of ways, including in the old national curriculum, where one of the identified key outcomes for primary school pupils was the development of awe and wonder, particularly in collective worship and religious education, but also in subjects including science and geography. As an archaeological scientist, wonder was a motivating factor in my exploration of the past. As a children's worker and now as an ordained minister, awe and wonder has been an important part of my work in schools and as a way of interesting both children and adults in spiritual matters. First of all, though, as a good scientist, I think that I'd better define my terms. What actually is wonder? What are we talking about? Well, like every good theological and philosophical concept, we can treat it a bit like Humpty Dumpty treats words in Alice Through the Looking Glass. When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean. Unfortunately, that's not very helpful, so I'll use the Oxford English Dictionary instead. The OED gives us two main senses of the noun wonder. The first, more common sense, is that of something that causes astonishment, including a marvellous object or miraculous deed. And the second sense of wonder, defined by the OED, is that of the emotion excited by the perception of something novel and unexpected or inexplicable, astonishment mingled with perplexity or bewildered curiosity. An emotion of mixed astonishment and curiosity, an intellectual movement beyond the feeling of amazement towards the desire to know why. Feeling wonder then is about being astonished, amazed, but then perhaps feeling that this astonishment is drawing us deeper into the mystery that we've uncovered, that there is more to what we have seen than something that just evokes amazement within us. I hope that will do as a working definition of what I mean, and we'll see where it gets us. And surprisingly, maybe, the first place I want to take us is to Richard Dawkins. Not with his book The God Delusion, but with his earlier, probably less well-known book, Unweaving the Rainbow. This was written after his first few books had become well-known. I don't know if anyone's read Unweaving the Rainbow. No real nods. This was, as you know, the first few books that he wrote, The Selfish Gene and so on, Dawkins was arguing that evolution had created all life by blind, pitiless accident. There was nothing else beyond that mechanism. So Unweaving the Rainbow was written to answer those people who'd complained about what they thought was the cold, bleak message of his earlier books. Dawkins seems rather surprised and a bit affronted that people thought that it was a cold, bleak message that he was pushing. And so he tries an unweaving to redress the balance. The book is subtitled Science, Delusion and the Appetite for Wonder. And at the centre of his argument is a celebration that within science, the sense of wonder is widespread and heartfelt. Dawkins seeks to show that it's the sense of wonder that motivates many scientists. He sums this up by saying that the feeling of awed wonder that science can give us is one of the highest experiences of which the human psyche is capable. As you have gathered from the subtitle, Dawkins being Dawkins, he also spends much of the book deploring the fact that wonder is so often attached to some form of pseudoscience, superstition or mysticism. He also uses the book to continue his feud with the late Stephen Jay Gould by seeking to distinguish between good and bad poetic science. Poetic science is basically Dawkins' acknowledgement that pretty much all science uses metaphors and images to convey its central concepts. Good poetic science seems to mean images that Dawkins agrees with, bad ones, ones that he doesn't. So the exploration of the actual feeling of wonder does get a bit lost in amongst everything else. But Dawkins does also speak of seeing the world as full of wonders and deriving pleasure from this sense of wonder. This sense of wonder, Dawkins argues, is enhanced by the scientific endeavour which can rescue us from the anaesthetic of familiarity. The concept of the anaesthetic of familiarity is in some ways the flip side of our shared sense of wonder. One of the things that we might want to wonder about is why we don't feel a sense of wonder more often or more keenly. I'll mention that again, I'll come back to the app, but for the moment I'll just leave it with a quote from that great modern-day thinker, Sir Terry Pratchett, from his book Mort. Pratchett's character Death says, "Human beings make life so interesting. Do you know that in a universe so full of wonders, they have managed to invent boredom?" Quite astonishing. Back to Dawkins. The title of the book, Unweaving the Rainbow, is taken from Keats' poem Lamia, retelling the ancient Greek myth. I'm going to read a small part of it in a moment, but when listening to it, it's worth remembering that the word philosophy at the time also referred to what we would call science. So in the middle of the poem, Keats writes this. "Do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We know her woof, her texture. She is given in the dull catalogue of common things. Philosophy will clip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air and gnomed mine, unweave a rainbow." So Dawkins interprets this poem as criticising Newton for destroying the poetry of the rainbow by reducing it to prismatic colours. Obviously, this is a sentiment with which Dawkins profoundly disagrees. Instead, he argues that good science should encourage wonder and poetry. As I've said, he argues that science is actually inspired by what he calls a poetic sense of wonder. Dawkins also says, "We have an appetite for wonder, a poetic appetite, which real science ought to be feeding." So Dawkins believes that science and wonder and poetry are all interrelated. Dawkins argues that good science is created and inspired by wonder. And in turn, he argues that good science can create, inspire, and also use good poetry. Unfortunately, as he admits, he isn't really able to give us any good examples of good poetry inspired by good science. But Dawkins is very convinced of the bridge between our sense of wonder and science, and between both those and the arts. And Dawkins is by no means alone in his linking of science and wonder. Over the last couple of years, the BBC has run two series of programmes presented by Professor Brian Cox called The Wonders of the Solar System and The Wonders of the Universe. They were both great series, for those of you who saw them, and explored both the science of the solar system and the universe, and also something of the wonder that the science evokes and that also drove the scientists exploring those things. And Brian Cox, a presenter of those series, is part of the team running the Large Hadron Collider, which is looking for, amongst other things, the Higgs boson. The completion of the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, and its switching on is perhaps the most recent example where the motivating role of wonder in science was clearly acknowledged. Brian Cox also presented a documentary on the LHC and the search for the Higgs boson. As part of this programme, various scientists expressed their motivations for their research. At the beginning of the programme, one of the leading researchers states, "We want to know why things are the way they are, how they work, what everything is. We want to understand." And in his final summary, Brian Cox concludes with, "And for me, that's what science at the Large Hadron Collider is all about. It represents the noblest side of humanity, our need to know." So the programme is framed by statements about wonder, statements about the longing and awe that the world evokes. It also shows how aware the programme makers are of the importance of this sense of wonder, our need to know, as an impulse for science. So this acknowledgement that wonder is an important motivating factor in science is pretty widespread and has come to prominence recently. However, in Unweaving the Rainbow, Dawkins doesn't stop there. And this is where his understanding of wonder gets more problematic. It gets more problematic because Dawkins insists that science is the only legitimate goal of the human appetite for wonder. He also responds to the charge that science cannot answer questions such as, "Where do you go when you die?" as beyond the limits of science, and so beyond what we could possibly know. Now, the good thing is that this insistence is probably a movement away from his earlier claim that such questions aren't legitimate or sensible to ask, but it still posits a false dichotomy between the limits of science and what we could possibly know. And actually, it's this attitude of Dawkins that rather proves Keats's point. Keats wrote, "All charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy." The rainbow, Keats argues, is something that should not simply be in the dull catalogue of common things. It should not be reduced to its unwoven colours. In other words, Keats is arguing against the very reductionism that Dawkins is using here to reduce what we can know to what can be known using the scientific method. I think that Keats might be going a little bit too far, though, as he's basically arguing that reducing the beautiful and awesome natural world to scientific theories and observations empties nature of its beauty and mystery. All charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy. The physicist Richard Feynman was very clear about this point. He said, "I have a friend who's an artist and has sometimes taken a view which I don't agree with very well. He'll hold up a flower and say, 'Look how beautiful it is,' and I'll agree. Then he says, 'I, as an artist, can see how beautiful this is, but you, as a scientist, take this all apart and it becomes a dull thing.' And I think he's kind of nutty. First of all, the beauty that he sees is available to other people and to me too, I believe. Although I may not be quite as refined aesthetically as he is, I can appreciate the beauty of a flower. At the same time, I see much more about the flower than he sees. I can imagine the cells in there, the complicated actions inside, which also have a beauty. I mean, it's not just beauty at this dimension, at 1 centimetre. There's also beauty at smaller dimensions, the inner structure, also the processes. The fact that the colours in the flower evolved in order to attract insects to pollinate, it is interesting. It means that insects can see the colour. It adds a question. Does this aesthetic sense exist in the lower forms, Why is it aesthetic? All kinds of interesting questions, which the science knowledge only adds to the excitement, the mystery and the awe of a flower. It only adds. I don't understand how it subtracts. The knowledge that science gives adds the excitement, the mystery, the awe. So Keats overstates his case somewhat. But he does still have a case, and particularly against attitudes like Dawkins. Keats complains that placing the rainbow in the dull catalogue of common things lessens it, which Feynman and myself would disagree with. But Keats argues that philosophy will clip an angel's wings. Here he is referring to the romantic understanding of nature as pointing to the divine, with cold philosophy preventing the discovery of the deeper spiritual dimensions. Crucially, it's a criticism of the belief that the analysis of the rainbow stops it from having some symbolic or imaginative significance. Keats protests that analysing nature reduces it and prevents us from catching the glimpses of the transcendent, those flashes of wonder that nature can otherwise provide. And that's exactly what Dawkins is doing. In stating that the limits of science are the limits of what we can know, Dawkins is adopting a position that only what can be measured truly exists. The challenge of the sense of wonder is that it fails to fall into these categories and also seems to point beyond itself. Much richer understanding reality is that reality consists of different levels. It's stratified. There are properties that emerge at one level which weren't evident from another. That seems to be far more consistent with what we encounter in science, let alone our encounters in the arts and in our faith journeys. And this sense of wonder isn't just confined as a motivating factor to scientists. It seems to lie behind quite a lot of human endeavour. George Mallory was asked why he wanted to climb Everest, and he famously replied, "Because it's there." I wonder if that's an echo of a sense of wonder, the desire for exploration of the amazing things that you've seen. And this isn't a recent desire either. A couple of years ago, Richard Holmes wrote The Age of Wonder, which is a biography of some of the leading 18th century British scientists. It's subtitled How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. The major cultural and philosophical movement at the time was Romanticism. That's one of those terms that's really difficult to define accurately, but it's a set of ideas around the delight in the marvellous, in strong emotions, in beauty and awe, and in individual loss and striving and imagination. Holmes argues that the passion that motivated many of these 18th century scientists can be summed up in that childlike but infinitely complex word, wonder. Holmes also seeks to show that science and romanticism weren't necessarily mutually exclusive, because they were united through the concept of wonder. Science with a basis in wonder is what Holmes terms romantic science. And one person who depicted the romantic attitude to science was the painter Joseph Wright of Derby, who painted laboratory and scientific scenes, but deliberately reinterpreted them as mysterious romantic moments of revelation and vision. In these paintings, Joseph Wright sought to deliberately raise questions about both the wonder and terror of science to depict different aspects of the romantic attitude to science. Now, talking about paintings when you can't actually see them is always going to be slightly odd, so I'm sorry about that, but I'm going to have a go at describing two of his most famous ones, which I'm hoping many of you know already. Both of these paintings are of lecturers demonstrating the use of scientific instruments in scenes which would have been reasonably familiar at the time. To give you a modern equivalent, if I said that someone had photographed a laboratory, you'd have a good idea of what I was talking about. You'd probably picture scientists in a white coat holding a test tube. So it's a shared understanding, and that was what Wright was drawing on. The first painting of Joseph Wright I want to talk to you about is the painting A Philosopher Giving a lecture on the Orrery. An orrery is a mechanical device designed to show the motion of the planets around the sun. So you've got a group of people, adults and children, male and female, clustered round the table on which the orrery is placed. To represent the sun is a lamp, although it isn't visible. But the lamp is the only source of light in the painting. Everything's illuminated by it, while the surroundings are in darkness. The philosopher is painted to look like Newton, and is clearly giving a lecture on the scientific understanding of the ordered, understood universe. The watchers are depicted as experiencing wonder, fascination, awe. They're wrapped by this newly understood order and are literally experiencing enlightenment, both physical enlightenment from the lamp, which symbolizes the intellectual enlightenment provided by Newton himself. This is science as illuminating the minds of the masses and providing wonder for all. It's quite a stirring, profound vision of what science can be about. But this vision and understanding is modified quite considerably in one of Wright's other famous paintings, An Experiment on a Bird in an Air Pump. This was first exhibited in 1768, just a couple of years after the orrery painting had been completed. The painting, An Experiment on a Bird in an Air Pump, reveals the more ambivalent aspects of the romantic vision of science. Superficially, the paintings are pretty similar. In both, the main illumination is from an unseen lamp on the central table, on which is placed the scientific instrument in question, which is being explained by the older male. Around the table, a group is clustered and illuminated, male and female, young and old. And in the second painting, the lecturer has placed a bird in a glass container and is about to demonstrate what happens to the bird when he turns the vacuum pump on, sucking all the air from the glass jar. Again, this was quite a common sight at the popular scientific lectures which took place up and down the country. But as well as the similarities between the two paintings, there are some significant differences. Unlike the orrery painting, the watchers have a wider range of reactions. There are still some people wrapped with wonder, but there are a pair of lovers with eyes only for each other. Two girls are clinging to each other, distraught at what's about to happen to the bird. The central candle is obscured by another jar in which there is a human skull. There's also another source of light visible through the window, is the moon just peeping through the clouds. In short, this air pump painting is deliberately ambivalent in character, combining the scientific with more disturbing aspects. Wright's painting of the air pump is designed to reflect some of the doubts that were being raised about whether scientific and rational knowledge could satisfactorily explain all the mysteries of nature. So this painting combines a depiction of the feelings of terror and wonder aroused by science, along with questions over its role. It's a great painting and well worth a visit to the National Gallery to have a look at. Obviously, you can Google it. Wright's painting of the air pump shows us something of the romantic view of science, which, at least some of the time, allowed room for the divine, with the natural world being seen as a gateway to the transcendent. Science was a gift of God that revealed the wonders of his design. There were problems with this attitude, though, and before too long, there was a shift away from the romantic notion of science, both inspiring and being inspired by wonder, towards a reductionist understanding of the world, which sought to separate science from the arts and from religion. This new attitude was heavily criticised by, amongst others, Thomas Carlyle, who in 1833 criticised that progress of science, which is to destroy wonder and in its stead substitute measuration and numeration. So in his book, The Age of Wonder, Richard Holmes concludes by making a plea that society and science learn from romantic science and reincorporate a sense of wonder into our society. He concludes, "We need the three things that a scientific culture can sustain: the sense of individual wonder, the power of hope, and the vivid but questing belief in a future for the globe." Wonder, hope, a belief in the future. As we've already seen, there's been a shift again in that wonder is now recognised again as a valid part of how scientists work and what motivates scientists. But I'm also convinced that Holmes is looking in the wrong place for wonder, hope, and a belief in a future. I'm convinced this isn't about a scientific culture, but those feelings, that outlook, can't be sustained by science, by the natural world. Rather, I think this points beyond the natural world. As I said when I was talking about Keats, this is a pretty widespread understanding. As I've also said, it was an important part of the Romantic movement that the natural world pointed beyond itself towards the divine. And it's a shame, really, that Holmes doesn't recognise this in his final plea. Another poet who did powerfully recognise this was the Victorian Jesuit priest, Gerard Manley Hopkins, who wrote, amongst other things, the poem God's Grandeur. This is what he wrote. "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is smeared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And where's man's smudge and shares man's smell? The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with our bright wings." The world is charged with the grandeur of God. The Holy Ghost broods over the bent world. Here is wonder, hope, and a belief in the future. But Hopkins also explores the other side of wonder, what Dawkins called the anesthetic of familiarity. "Why do men then not now wreck his rod?" Hopkins wonders and then answers. "All is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod." I think that's a pretty fair assessment of some of the problems with our culture, that it creates and sustains an anesthetic of familiarity, a clamour that prevents us from seeing God's grandeur. There's been quite a lot written about this part of the sense of wonder by Christian authors. There's some really helpful books out there about rediscovering and reawakening our sense of wonder. Perhaps the most helpful that I've read has been Michael Iaconelli's Dangerous Wonder. There are also lots of Christian books with the word wonder in the title, although quite often they don't really go on to explore wonder, they just kind of assume it. I can't quite decide whether that's helpful or not. Be as that may, in Dangerous Wonder, Michael Iaconelli wrote, "I want a lifetime of holy moments. Each day I want to be in dangerous proximity to Jesus. I long for a life that explodes with meaning and is filled with adventure, wonder, risk and danger. I long for a faith that is gloriously treacherous. I want to be with Jesus, not knowing whether to cry or laugh." That's an inspiring vision of what faith should be about, a life filled with meaning, adventure, wonder, risk and danger. Read the rest of the book, it's well worth it. Again, I think that this desire for meaning and longing for wonder, which Iaconelli recognises as so important for a living faith, are also the drivers for much of science and much of art. I think it acts as a bridge between all three, a way of drawing them all closer together. So then, what does this say about our theology? What does it say about how we understand ourselves? I talked at the start about Augustine's well-known prayer that our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. I also said that I thought this was only half the story. Augustine saw fallen humanity as questing after God and experiencing emptiness and dissatisfaction until finding God. He thought that human longing for God is built in as part of who we were made to be. He also knew that this longing could be misdirected and talks in some length in his Confessions about how he personally misdirected his human longings. But he talks at greater length about how eventually his longings were directed towards God. And part of those longings are, I think, what I've been calling wonder, our awe, our astonishment, our desire to know more. And lots of people since have gone along with this. The modern take on this is the pretty widespread understanding of a God-shaped gap, a God-shaped hole. The argument is pretty much the same as that of Augustine. We're unfulfilled without God. Without God, there will always be an emptiness, a searching, a sense that something is missing. And what's missing is that relationship with God. And I think that's a pretty compelling argument as far as it goes. I think it chimes with what we've been exploring about our sense of wonder, that there's a sense that there's more to life than what we can see. But actually, I think this understanding is less than half the story. When we have that relationship with God, it's at least implied in these arguments, we'll no longer have that sense of yearning, of searching. My problem with this understanding is that that's not actually my experience. I don't think it's the experience of many people, and I don't think it's what we find in the Bible either. I quoted from Hebrews either earlier, which talks about Abraham and others longing for a heavenly country. So our hearts are restless, yes, but I have more problems with until they find their rest in you, at least before we reach that heavenly country. But the other thing I have a problem with the God-shaped gap theology, is it's essentially negative. It sees this yearning as part of our fallen humanity, one of the things that we have because we're estranged from God, because although made in the image of God, that image has been marred and distorted. So this is essentially negative. It's something we have because we're fallen and won't have when we have a strong enough relationship with God, whether that happens in this life or the next. I think, though, that our sense of wonder is a positive part of being made in the image of God, not a negative. This sense of wonder is a positive driver towards our exploration of the glories of God's creation, and so to an enhanced appreciation of God. As well as that, this positive sense of wonder, this desire to explain the universe, is reflected in the arts and also in science as a driver towards creativity and questioning. This is also where we reach the limits of scientific exploration. Science makes a set of working assumptions which enable us to get on and do scientific exploration. But those working assumptions aren't really, or sometimes at all, explicable by science itself. These are the sorts of things that Dawkins puts in the beyond the limits of what we can know box. But it's quite a big box, so let's take a peek. First of all, there's our sense of wonder itself. That's a basic driver behind science, a desire to know that makes at least some of us feel that science is worth doing. Quite honestly, as an archaeologist, there's no other reason that I'd be in the middle of a muddy field in the cold, other than an insatiable desire to know. And the same goes for working long days and nights in a lab as well. Obviously, this sense of wonder can be seen to have some evolutionary benefits, but as we know, curiosity killed the cat, so it has some evolutionary pitfalls as well. So, a bit on the edge. More firmly in the not very explicable category is why the human mind is able to understand and explore so much of how the universe works. We're really pushing those limits at the moment with quantum mechanics. To quote Feynman again, he said, "I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics." That's mainly because, as Feynman also says, there's a conflict between reality and your feeling of what reality ought to be. But the wonder is not that we're struggling with our limitations now, it's that it's taken so long to get there. And even despite not really understanding it, people seem to be making a good go of working out what they don't understand. And the reason that humans can come up with theories about how the universe works, even though we don't really understand them, is very firmly in Dawkins' category of beyond the limits of what we can know. And that's what's been called the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. The maths that those of you who can do proper maths can do and understand also allows us to represent how the universe is structured and ordered. Physicists who use maths to explore the world talk about the beauty that those equations have. To quote Feynman yet again, "To those who do not know mathematics, it's difficult to get across a real feeling as to the beauty, the deepest beauty of nature. If you want to learn about nature, to appreciate nature, it's necessary to understand the language she speaks in." I'm a member of a fairly small organisation that you probably haven't heard of, called the Society of Ordained Scientists. I think that's fairly self-explanatory. Scientists aren't always very good at names. And obviously not that many people meet the basic membership criteria anyway. But one of the founder members is John Polkinghorne, who is both a theoretical physicist and an ordained Church of England minister. Reflecting on those things which science assumes but can't really explain, Polkinghorne argues that the search for understanding will be found to be the search for God. The search for understanding will be found to have been the search for God. So more specifically, the search for understanding, the longing for meaning, the feeling of wonder can be grounded in the understanding of being made in the image of God. We've been created with the ability to peer into the mind of God. Our understanding of being made in the image of God is really taken from just a couple of verses in Genesis 1. Then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. This passage emphasizes that humanity bears the divine image and stresses that this divine image is shared by both male and female. It shows humanity is the climax of creation and cared for by God. That much is certain. After that, it all gets a bit more problematic. The word translated image only occurs 17 times in the Bible, and it isn't really clear exactly what it means. So there have been a large number of different understandings of what made in the image of God actually means. The three main interpretations that modern theologians like to disagree over are that image refers either to humanity's capacity for reason, or to humanity being God's representatives here on earth, or to humanity's capacity to relate to God. Reason, representatives, or relationship. I'm sorry, that's a rather cheesy three words beginning with the same letter. Anyway, so theologians continue to argue over which of these three interpretations is most likely. But I'm now going to go all a bit Anglican on you and say, well, it's probably a bit of all of them. It's also entirely possible that the understanding of the image of God was deliberately left ambiguous and open-ended to encourage reflection on the liberating understanding that humans are uniquely made by God, are closer in their relation to him than the rest of creation, and through this have a special relationship with God, with their fellow humans, and with the rest of creation. And part of this special relationship, I think, is our sense of wonder. Another wonderfully ambiguous verse that suggests this is in Ecclesiastes. When I confess that Ecclesiastes is one of my favourite books in the Bible, most people divide between blank looks, as they haven't heard of it before, or horrified stares that anyone could like that book. Isn't it really depressing? I get asked. I then explain at some length why it isn't, at which point the questioner starts agreeing with me, just to escape. Don't worry though, I'm just going to talk about one verse, Ecclesiastes 3:11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart, yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Actually, I can go on for some time about just this verse. But to summarise, no one's really sure what half the words mean. The words translated as eternity can mean things including darkness, time, aged, and world. The phrase no one can fathom is, ironically enough, ambiguous, as it could be either positive or negative. However, despite the lack of clarity over the exact meaning, it does suggest that God has placed within us something that encourages us to look beyond what we can see, beyond life under the sun, to use another phrase from Ecclesiastes. Obviously, this understanding of how God has created us is an important part of what I've been talking about, over the purpose and importance of humanity's feeling of wonder. And this verse was actually used by some key thinkers to suggest a biblical basis for a bridge of wonder between science and theology. Galileo used it to argue that it gave freedom to continue the search for new discoveries, as not everything had been disclosed. Sometime later, Martin Luther agreed, saying that the natural inquiry was supported in Ecclesiastes. He wrote, "The benefit of these arts are many and great, as is plain to see every day. In addition, there is not only utility, but also great pleasure in investigating the nature of things." John Ruskin also spoke of the importance for him of this verse in deepening his sense of wonder. "The woods which I had only looked on as wilderness, fulfilled I then saw, in their beauty, the same laws which guided the clouds, divided the light, and balanced the wave. He hath made everything beautiful in his time, became for me thenceforward the interpretation of the bond between the human mind and all visible things." To which I think we should add, "and a bond between the human mind and the creator of all things, visible and invisible." I want to finish with one final example of the importance of wonder, and that's the encounter of Moses with God through the burning bush. When I was ordained, I was given an icon of Moses depicted in the middle of tearing off his sandals and flinging them to the ground in front of the burning bush. And one of the things it reminds me of when I look at it is because Moses was doing that because Moses' sense of wonder that he had this encounter with God. Moses was out tending Jethro's flock when he saw a burning bush which was not consumed by the flames. So naturally, he went over to see that strange sight. His sense of wonder at what was happening led to an encounter with God. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, in her narrative poem, Aurora Leigh, sums up quite a lot of what I've been trying to say. She wrote, "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round it and pluck blackberries, and daub their natural faces unaware, more and more." Every common bush is afire with God. In my wonderings about wonder, I hope that I've suggested some ways in which wonder should play more of a part in our lives, in our spiritual journeys, in our churches, and also as a way of making bridges between our Christian experience of the world and our experience as artists and scientists, and as people who enjoy and make use of both. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Graham. We have got a few minutes for questions, if anybody has a question.
This isn't going to so much be a question as a little story, if you don't mind.
Yeah, great, carry on.
It's a story about rainbows. I've got a Monday-only ticket, so I was out in the real world yesterday. And I was driving up and down the M1 going south, and it was really weird weather where I was. I assume it was really weird weather here yesterday as well. There was a bit of everything. But we were driving into the sun, and it was raining behind us, and I could see in my rearview mirror a rainbow following us. So as we were moving forward, the rainbow was behind us, and it stayed the same distance behind us the whole time. I'm a science teacher, and I'd seen a picture of a rainbow taken from the top of a really tall tower in Toronto, and the picture was into the rainbow, and because this tower is so high and the people are on the top deck, they could see the rainbow as an entire circle. And the very top deck of the Toronto Tower was shadowed, and the shadow of where this photograph was taken from was right in the centre of the rainbow. And I was thinking about this, and it actually means that every rainbow you ever see is yours, and yours alone. Now, I don't know what you think about with rainbows, whether you think about promises to Noah or whether you just think about God's beauty and his ability to create all this sort of stuff. But that promise isn't to even the person next to you, it's just to you. Because that rainbow that you see is a different rainbow to the person sitting right next to you. So every rainbow you ever see is just for you and you alone.
Yeah, no, thank you, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. I missed the beginning of your talk, so forgive me if you've already covered this, but I think it was Wordsworth who wrote in Ode to Intimations to Immortality, "The earth and every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light," and he's describing the sense of wonder that youngsters have. You know, we've seen it, some of us older folk, in our children. Mm. I've got a wonderful picture of my daughter unpeeling a tangerine at the age of about three, sat in her high chair, and the look on her face is totally exquisite and wonderful. But as life goes on, you know, as Wordsworth points out, he says, "It is not now as it has been before. The things that I have seen, I now can see no more." I wondered, I actually spoke quite recently on the sense of wonder to my local fellowship, and how that wonder can be reinvigorated and sustained through the Christian faith. And I wonder, is that something that you've covered this morning, and wonder what your feelings are on that?
I kind of mentioned it briefly by kind of referring people to sort of all the books that do it, including Michael Giacchinelli's The Dangerous Wonder, yeah, which is kind of all about getting back to this childlike sense of wonder that we so often lose. That actually taking time to experience wonder in the same way that we see children experiencing wonder, like of our own individual rainbows or of peeling a tangerine or all those things that children just go stop and go wow at, and we kind of, you know, this anesthetic of familiarity, as Dawkins puts it. And I think there's loads of different ways we can kind of strive to regain our sense of wonder. That for me as a scientist, it's about these new explorations, these new discoveries, give me that wow factor. I think it's about things like Greenbelt. I think one of the main reasons that loads of us come to Greenbelt is to experience some of that wow again, that wonder, because we see things in a slightly different way. I think a lot of it is about getting us to move outside the things that have been dulled by this sense of familiarity, no matter how wonderful they are, and looking at them through a different prism. So through a different artist's perspective of the world, or through a different scientist's perspective of the world, or just taking time to read the Bible in a different way and experiencing God through that. I think there's loads of different sort of techniques we can do to actually reinvigorate that sense of wonder. And I think we as church leaders should be doing that a bit more than actually we do, really.
It's more of a question of a help. My daughter's just done her IGCSEs, and she's got 9 A stars. And she wants to go to Cambridge and do maths. She was a Christian, but she's sort of fallen away, and sort of science and maths has sort of taken over. She'll read and read, but what can I do to help come maybe back into the fold? What book or whatever? Or just left Cambridge when she goes there to hold devices and hope she gets converted back to Christianity?
Well, a bit of that as well. But Alistair McGrath has written some really good books looking at these kind of things. The Reenchantment of Nature is a very good one of his that talks about some of the stuff I've been talking about. It talks about wonder and why that there's more to nature than what we can see. So the Reenchantment of Nature by Alistair McGrath is a good one to start with, and loads of these other things too, if she's got specific questions about sort of the science faith thing. But that's a good one to start with.
I get that written down for somebody now. Thanks.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you for your talk, Graham. I enjoyed it this morning. I'm not sure if this question's finally formed yet, but I'll have a go. I totally agree with what you say about the Brian Cox stuff on television and the wonder that taps into. I think my question is more about those other forms of wonder, and it's a question that's something to do with the fact that those scientific questions seem to have great currency in our media world. You know, those powers that be that help us think through the media accept that. My question is really, is there ways that we as Christians can encourage an integrity and an acceptance to the other forms of wonder that as well that we would want to ask people to explore and to look at. You know, the scientific thing seems to have credibility. If you, as soon as you start mentioning this thing about, you know, wonder drives us towards God, it doesn't seem to have the credibility in society, and I'm wondering how we can appeal for that credibility, for those other forms of wonder that go alongside it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think it might be better answered by a PR expert than me, but I'll have a go. I think the first thing to do is to work off the back of that sense of wonder that is acknowledged, which is kind of a bit of what I've been trying to do. Work, say, okay, so these amazing scientific discoveries, wow, they're wonderful, aren't they? So what's this about? What's this wonder about? And actually, one of the things I think we can do more as churches is engage with people through those scientific discoveries. So put on events and things that start with science and the wonder of science, and then lead people towards it. So the this weekend, the Test of Faith series by the Faraday Institute has been sort of plugged by various people. So I'll give it a plug as well. Test of Faith is a sort of short course that the Faraday Institute have produced, and one of the things that does is it seeks to say that scientists can also have a Christian faith, that the two aren't incompatible, that the two work together, and sort of takes people on that sort of journey. So that's perhaps one practical way we can sort of move people from one to the other.
Any other questions?
I am struggling a little with your association of a sense of wonder with a need to know, because it seems to me that the need to know is the thing that suppresses the sense of wonder.
Can you say a bit more about that? Why do you think that? Why do you think they're in opposition? Why do you think that a need to know suppresses wonder?
Because I think to find wonder, you need to give free rein to your emotions, possibly, and it is the feelings of wonder that are the things that make it what it is. And by putting your rational mind into gear, you suppress those emotions.
I don't think I do, and I think this might be a scientist-artist dichotomy rather than a Christian-non-Christian dichotomy, in that I experience wonder through digging up small bits of pottery and all the rest of it, and through analysing those bits and seeing the numbers and get a fresh sense of wonder when I work out that this rock was traded from 300 kilometres away or whatever. So I get a sense of wonder from doing the rational stuff. Like in that sort of long quote I read from Feynman, you can get a renewed sense of wonder by being able to look at the world around us and not just see it as it is, but see all the things that are going on to make it as it is. So I think that the rational understanding can help us re-engage our emotions at a different level. So that's where I see those coming in.
Anyone else?
Thanks. I was just going to pick up on that last discussion, because I went to something about nature as a spiritual director with Bruce Stanley the other night, and he was talking about a circle of different attitudes that could help us in our sort of spirituality, and he had awe, meditation and study, and he talked about moving around the circle and how in between awe and study there may be something where sometimes understanding something more can lead us more to awe through our understanding. But it you can be captured by different parts of that circle, and it's perhaps having the freedom to move around it so that when you want to see something and understand it, you don't try and possess it. You allow it to still speak to you in its own way. But it may be that sometimes the understanding can actually deepen that. But perhaps we're more content to be at different parts of the circle depending on who we are.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that the challenge is to make sure that we all of us do all the different bits of the circle. So actually, it does join up as a circle. And actually, this sense of awe and study actually feed into one another rather than us just staying in either bit, really. So thank you.
I think it's more of an observation, and going back to the gentleman that's gone now, but he was talking about how do we get that credibility of the wonder and the awe of God. And what struck me as you were speaking, was actually that anaesthetic of familiarity is something that's actually now within our churches.
Mm.
And so yeah. I think if we want to convince other people outside of the church of the awe of wonder of God, maybe we've got to engage a little bit more with it ourselves within our churches.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with that. I think the hard part then is working out how to do that practically and realistically. But yeah, I think that's the challenge.
Thank you. Can I just come back on that because of the point that the gentleman at the back here raised about the relationship between the cerebral mind and thinking and intellect and a childlike sense of wonder. When I was preparing to talk to people about wonder the other day, and it's just been wonderful hearing what you've said. Sorry about the choice of words there. But I found myself thinking about what Jesus said, and that's always going to be a great place to go, whatever we're thinking about, isn't it? And he said, unless you become as little children, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. And I've always thought of that in terms of trust, you know, putting his hand in its mother or father's hand and trusting the mum or dad to look after it. But it struck me while I was thinking about this that it's the childlike sense of wonder that perhaps was part of what the Lord Jesus was thinking about when he told his disciples that, unless you become as little children. So I think sometimes we have to somehow detach ourselves from the intellect and not be so swayed and affected by that and let go of that and just find through his grace that ability to just wonder about the beauty that surrounds us all in every possible way.
Maybe just comment on that as a fellow but lapsed member of the Society of Ordained Scientists. As a priest, I'm a minister of word and sacrament, and word is about intellect. Sacrament, in an orthodox understanding, is about seeing something ordinary and saying, there is God. And that, for me, unites what it is to be a scientist, but also a priest as well.
Mm, yeah, thank you, yes.
My second chance of speaking, how exciting. The gentleman just behind me, who I couldn't see, who was just talking about childlike appreciation of things, I get that, the idea of wow, and leaving it at that. But when I was a kid, I always wanted to take stuff apart and work out how it works. And I think it's the phrase horses for courses. I think some people like the idea of staring at something and going, that is cool. And some people want to just investigate it a bit further in order to find out how genuinely cool it is. And I'm the second. And I love rainbows. I think are brilliant. I could stare at rainbows forever. But I am playing in my head with wavelengths and refractive indexes and all that sort of stuff. And I think however much we scratch the surface of the science of God, we only ever reveal another layer which is yet to be investigated. And God's beauty in his creation and his universe is far, far too deep for us to even trouble. We're never going to find the answers. And it's fun trying to find out what some of those answers are. So, yeah, totally with you. Appreciate things as a child, but some children really want to take stuff apart.
Absolutely, and both of those are the sense of wonder. The childlike sense of wonder which looks and perhaps then goes on to paint or create inspired by it, and there's the childlike sense of wonder which goes away and pulls it apart just to see what all the individual bits go. And I think they're both united by that sense of wonder, and I think that sense of wonder also is united to our sense of God and are being drawn back to God by this sense of wonder, which expresses itself in loads of different ways, depending on our personalities and all the rest of it.
I studied physics at university, and one of the things, I don't remember very much of what I learnt, but one of the things that really stuck with me was the fact that science, the thing that they really drilled into us was that science, or good science, is about keeping an open mind and about kind of following the evidence where it leads you and kind of not saying, well, these are the facts and this is exactly what we know, so we've got that sorted, so let's leave that alone, but actually constantly kind of exploring it and testing it and kind of driving it to see what, see the kind of limits of it and see, see what depths there are. And actually science is very good at that, kind of keeping that open mind and keeping that wonder and being ready to kind of adapt if there's new new discoveries and things. Whereas actually theology kind of feels like it ought to be like that, but often isn't like that. And often we kind of say, well, this is what we know, and this is kind of, these are our kind of set things that we know, so we're happy with that, and we're not going to kind of dig deeper and develop that kind of wonder. And actually, kind of, if we're content to do that with the natural world, which is amazing and huge but not infinite, then why don't we kind of do that with God, who is infinite and who has such hidden depths that we can never understand? And actually, a kind of the idea of wonder that we have in science, and scientists are very good at kind of digging into, perhaps in theology and in our kind of Christian walk, we need to do the same and not kind of be stuck with, this is just what we know and we're happy with that.
I think that's a good place to end. Thank you.